Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
Do you know?
The concept of interplanetary and interstellar travel has been the stuff of dreams for much of human history, the stuff of science fiction for more than a century, and increasingly, the stuff of scientific progress in our new millennium. As the Voyager spacecraft carries a map to our beautiful blue-green Earth into the vastness of space outside our solar system, as the Hubble telescope brings us pictures of the furthest reaches of space and the earliest moments of time, as commercial spacecraft carry payloads into orbit, and as America plans for a trip to Mars, the question remains, is anybody out there, or are we the only ones? I'm Glenn Moberg. Joining us today on Route 51 to help answer those questions are Dr. Margaret Maggie Turnbull, an Antigo High School graduate who has pioneered groundbreaking research with NASA in the search for Earth-like planets, and whose organization, the Global Science Institute, seeks to expand humanity's frontiers. Also, Dr. Randy Olson, director of the Allen F. Blocker Planetarium at UW-Stevens Point. And a little later in this program, we'll be joined by Chris Janssen, the director of the Wausau School District Planetarium at Wausau West High School. What do you think? Is there life on other worlds, maybe as close as our own solar system? Or are we alone, even among the countless billions of stars and planets? Do you long for humankind to make contact with an alien species, or do you worry about the consequences? And what do you think of the president's plans to take us to Mars? Give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That number again is 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. And Maggie Turnbull joining us from Skype from the Minocqua area. Thanks so much for being with us today, especially on short notice.
Hi, Glenn. Thanks for having me.
And Randy Olson, thank you for coming here on short notice as well from UW-Stevens Point. It's great to have you here.
Happy to be here, Glenn.
Maggie Turnbull, you're an astrobiologist. Now, the implication of that title is that you believe that there is biology in outer space, life on other worlds. Why do you think that?
Well, I think that astrobiology is, as a science, is really just the quest to find out what is out there. So I'm not necessarily going into it with a super strong conviction about the answer, but I have to say that just given the diversity of life on this one tiny little planet, and the questions about its origins and whether it even originated here, we have to consider the possibility that life could actually be a very widespread phenomenon throughout the galaxy and the universe.
What do you mean by the question of whether or not it actually originated here?
Was that a provocative thing to say?
I think so.
I was hoping you'd pick up on that. There is an idea that, you know, early on in the Earth's history, it actually was not very habitable here. And there was a lot going on with volcanic activity. There were a lot of impacts from asteroids and comets delivering water to the Earth that we're now very glad to have. But Mars back then may have been a much more pleasant place to live. And the idea is that life could have, not saying it did for sure, but it's just one idea that life could have gotten a foothold on Mars first and then been transported here by subsequent impacts with asteroids and comets that would have blown Mars rocks off into space and eventually landed on Earth. And it's not crazy because we have actually found Mars rocks on Earth. meteorites that have fallen and been collected off of the Antarctic ice sheet that are definitely from Mars.
Maggie, how did a girl from Antigo end up doing pioneering work for NASA looking for life on other worlds? That's a question a lot of people have.
Well, a girl from Antigo that has had, you know, lifelong exposure to the outdoors and just the beauty of nature. And I think that those kinds of experiences, being in a more wild area or a less developed area, just naturally draw your curiosity. And pretty soon you're observing and thinking about how nature fits together so amazingly well. And pretty soon you want to be an astronaut. And then you watch some Star Trek and read some science fiction, and you're on your way.
tell us a little bit about this organization of yours, the Global Science Institute. And we'd also like to let our listeners know that we do have a link to your Facebook page on our Route 51 Facebook page.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, the Global Science Institute, to be perfectly honest, is it's a nonprofit that I started just so that I would be able to move back to Wisconsin and continue doing the science that I do and have a way to interface with NASA and other, you know, big institutions like in the aerospace industry and universities and other big nonprofits, and continue doing my science, you know, not just as Maggie Turnbull, but as the director of the Global Science Institute. Sometimes a piece of paper can go a long way in establishing credibility, and I just needed another channel. But it also has served to allow me to do some pretty neat local programs as a nonprofit. You know, I can take donations and then use that to set up little projects in the community with the schools or just with the community in general to try to carry out some environmental-related projects and science-related things.
You know, a lot of people don't look at Antigo as being a hotbed of interstellar research.
Right. Well, these days, with the Internet, people can work from almost anywhere, provided they don't need a lot of fancy equipment. And in my case, as long as I have my, you know, my brain working and my laptop and an internet connection, I can be in wonderful meetings all day long with my colleagues all over the country and doing the kind of work that I know how to do with the stars and all of that data. And so I don't really require any particular location, which actually was a little bit of a revelation to me, too, because I wasn't sure what would happen moving back here. But
right.
Turns out I just keep right on working with all the same people I was working with before.
Let's move to Randy Olson now. Dr. Olson, you are the head of the Allen F. Blocker Planetarium and the observatory at UW-Stevens Point. So there's a fair amount of interest in astronomy in central Wisconsin.
Oh, yes. We have probably about 10,000 visitors to the planetarium every year. And with the Arthur Pascha Observatory, we are expecting probably at least half as many through that facility during the course of a year.
Tell us a little bit about the observatory. What's the telescope like? What can you see? How practical is it to have an observatory in Stevens Point, which is, you know, it's not a big city, but it's a city nonetheless.
Well, there has actually been a telescope on the Stevens Point campus all the way back to some of its earliest days. But one of the things that we find it useful for is giving our students an opportunity to train in what they may experience in a research facility. We have a 0.4-meter telescope, and that one is large enough to image galaxies as well as doing some research in terms of solar system objects or some stellar systems that are nearby.
Do many of your students go on to graduate school in astronomy? You know, there aren't a that many institutions that have working planetariums and observatories.
That's true. But most of our students that do have an interest in that are majoring in physics, and many of those do go on either in physics or in astronomy in terms of graduate studies. In fact, last year alone, we had two people that are now at one at Ball State and one out in Oregon.
How important is it to teach astronomy and physics at the college level and to fund research in these topics?
Well, that's really where sort of the rubber hits the road, because by doing the research, you are not only keeping yourself current in the field, but you're also giving the students an opportunity, because that's where most of us, you know, really tie it in. We have students working with us, even if we are going out for a week of observing time, which we do have every year, at Kitt Peak National Observatory outside of Tucson. So this gives the students an opportunity to actually experience research firsthand.
Maggie Turnbull, are we investing enough in the pure research that could lead to new discoveries in astronomy and physics?
Well, I think, you know, funding, I have never known funding to not be a challenge in the sciences. And, you know, I guess I'd like to say no, but in the grand scheme of things, there are just so many different obligations that are, you know, the public purse has taken on that it's going to continue to be a struggle for a long time. So things are going to have to move forward at whatever pace they can. But my hope is that what will happen is we have some really neat new ideas on the table that will not break the bank, but that are big steps forward. And if those ideas can result in some really amazing new discoveries, that will precipitate more funding, you know, in the direction of space exploration, especially for, you know, other Earth-like planets and this profound question of whether we're alone in the universe.
How do you respond to people who say this stuff just isn't practical for most people? We should be concentrating more on job training and things that will help us on Earth right now.
I guess the best response that I can come up with, which is not contrived, like this does come from the heart, is that it's not an either or question. We really have to do these things together. I mean, I don't know where I'd be right now if, as a kid, you know, growing up, there had been no space program to speak of, or, you know, there hadn't been scientific discoveries happening right and left. And that comes because of investments that are made both on the public and the private side. And some of those investments will not be made except for on the public side, at least to get them started. And once they're started, then private industry tends to get interested and invest more. But I think that, you know, in order to motivate and inspire younger people to even go into these science and technology fields in the first place, it all comes down to the pure research and the discovery and the sense of exploration and adventure and expanding our horizons.
You know, according to a recent survey, 42% say they support the U.S. spending billions of dollars on programs destined for the moon, Mars, and the asteroids, but a larger share, 50%, oppose spending that money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can't really blame people, because that sounds like a lot of money. And, you know, especially when you're answering a question like that, you know, I'm not sure I would know how to answer it either, because, you know, what are you talking about? Spending that much money over how much time, and what would the goals be of doing that? Like, just to put people on these other, you know, planetary bodies, or are we talking about some ultimate higher purpose of doing that? And as you know, I'm not, I am, although my original, back in the day, my original inspiration was to be an astronaut. Now I've discovered that there's so much more exploration, true scientific exploration happening, not through the manned space program, but through, you know, orbiting observatories and just instrument development. So I think I would want to know pretty clearly, you know, why are we sending people to these other places? Like, what is our ultimate goal there?
Well, Randy Olson, what do you think of those statistics? 42% say, yeah, let's spend the money, but a greater majority say, no, let's not do it.
Well, in many cases, they're just thinking about the ultimate, you know, what does it do for me? And rather than looking at the fact that if you take a look at the space program of the 60s and 70s, there were literally tens of thousands of offshoots that would have never gotten invented had it not been for the space program.
Be specific.
A lot of them are things that you don't realize. For example, there are tennis shoes that have been redesigned based on space program ideals. And when you start looking at, for example, the people that are involved in crop dusting, a lot of times those planes get a little bit on the warm side, flying in the middle of summer. And so what some of them actually have are suits that have liquid cooling running through them so that they can be reasonably safe and comfortable while doing their job.
There must have been a vast improvement in computer technology associated with all of that space travel, too. And you know, look at how computers are such an important part of our lives today.
Oh, exactly. In fact, the miniaturization of those, that's the reason that people are running around now with cell phones that are more important than interpersonal communications in some respects.
And Maggie Turnbull, I find it interesting, you know, I quoted that statistic, 42% support spending money on research, 50% do not. But those statistics were similar to American sentiment in 1967 before Neil Armstrong walked on the moon.
Right. Yeah, well, I guess, you know, I mean, I appreciate the spin-offs, you know, that come from programs like this, but I really think it comes down to just pure and simple inspiration. And no president wants to be without a vision, you know, a grand vision for the future of humanity and how he or she is going to, you know, help make that happen with the United States at the forefront. But, but ultimately it comes down to inspiration. And I think that, yeah, I mean, for people who are not a big fan of those numbers, people probably are, you know, like Randy was saying, just thinking about this, we have practical real world problems right now that need to get solved. But without realizing that a lot of those problems, even if you completely bankrupted NASA, you know, and just got rid of it and threw all that money into social programs, and whatnot, you're still going to have a lot of social problems to deal with. It's not going to solve everything. NASA's budget is not as big as people think it is, even though that sounds like a lot of money.
I want to mention also that we do have a link to the Allen F. Blocker Planetarium and the Observatory on our Route 51 Facebook page. Maggie, tell us a little bit about your work as the lead scientist developing NASA's New Worlds Observer mission. What were the kinds of things that you're involved in?
Well, the New Worlds Observatory was a concept for a space telescope larger than the Hubble to fly with another spacecraft, a second spacecraft called a Starshade. And it's kind of a novel idea for how to block out the light of a nearby star in order to see planets orbiting around them. And, you know, a planet is just a tiny little speck of light that is nigh impossible to see in the glare of a bright star. But we would fly a gigantic star-shaped piece of plastic, basically, in front of the telescope and align the two of them to block out the light of the star and be able to see planets then amongst our nearest neighbors, which is not a search we've carried out yet. So we would actually even be able to see Earth-like planets in the habitable zones of the nearest stars. So it was really a novel idea. And since then, I became involved in another study to do this on a smaller scale because such a large-scale flagship mission, like we were just saying, may not be in the cards for NASA's budget. And in the course of putting together with this with the other scientists on this NASA committee, the idea of a smaller probe scale mission to fly with a smaller starshade, we eventually settled on a new idea, which is that NASA is going to be flying a mission called WFIRST. And this mission is highlighted on the Exoplanets Exploration website for NASA. And it'll be a space telescope that's going to accomplish a wide range of astrophysics. But if we could fly a starshade with that mission, then we would not have to build a separate telescope. We just fly the starshade. And all of a sudden, that mission becomes a very interesting exoplanets exploration program, an exploration for habitable planets around the nearest stars. So we're looking at that now, and I can't believe it, but the idea is actually becoming very interesting from a multitude of perspectives. The starshade used to be this black sheep kind of crazy thing, fringe idea, and now in the last year and a half or so, the tide has just absolutely turned on that, and suddenly it's like, wow, you know, this is actually a really simple way to enhance the performance of any space telescope. And furthermore, it represents a really cool opportunity for the astronauts to think about servicing this starshade and refueling it. And it would have to be in an orbit that is not in low Earth orbit. It would have to be in orbit around the sun, which represents another step forward in human spaceflight capability and servicing missions, which plays into what we were just talking about the possibility of, you know, getting humans back on the moon and maybe eventually out to Mars.
You know, we put human beings on the moon back in the early 70s, and we haven't been back since then. Did we drop the ball on scientific exploration, Randy Olson?
To some extent, if you wanted to go back to the moon today, it would take you almost a decade just to get back there. And that's because all of that technology that was developed for that wound up essentially coming up in 1960s technology. And so that was one of the reasons that took place and that we have now lost that ability. So we're now looking at building another rocket that is designed to, again, be able to get us out of Earth orbit.
And the president says that he wants us to go to Mars. Randy, what do you think of that?
Interesting concept. I still think that if you are talking about it eventually, that would be nice, but we are still in the process of trying to do a lot of remote studies on Mars. Curiosity rover is still running around on the surface, as is Opportunity these days. So we're still trying to get a much better idea as to what Mars is really like by studying it with our remote probes first.
Maggie Turnbull, is it a good idea to go to Mars?
Well, I think that you can learn a lot on the way there and just by attempting that. So, you know, in theory, I would say, yeah, let's do it. Let's try it. Let's see what happens. But I'm not going to take any promises seriously until it shows up in the budget. And right now, you know, just looking at the proposed budget for fiscal year 2016, it's not, I mean, the budget has remained flat for a while now. And in order to accomplish that ambitious of a goal, we're talking about, you know, massively ramping up the human spaceflight exploration program, and the budget has to swell accordingly. We're not seeing that right now. So as far as I can tell, it's just talk. It's talk and a little bit of action, and I guess we'll see where it goes. It would be interesting to give it a try.
You know, we've had science fiction stories and movies about people encountering alien life forms. Well, going back over 100 years now to when H.G. Wells wrote War of the Worlds, were you inspired by any of these movies and science fiction stories, Maggie Turnbull?
Well, my inspiration goes back to it really began just with nature and with not so much fiction, but just these incredible, I mean, nature kind of feels like science fiction sometimes because it's just so unbelievable, the diversity of animals and the planets that are out there. Even in my childhood, you know, just pictures of the planets in the outer solar system were
But you did watch old science fiction movies, didn't you?
When I was a little bit old, like in high school, I got into Star Trek The Next Generation with a passion. And in college, the movie Contact came out, and that completely altered my career trajectory because I was I was so moved by that whole story that I actually ended up working with the real-life counterpart to Jodie Foster's character. And that then, you know, led me pretty much directly to where I am today.
In your search, but, in the search for inhabitable worlds.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I did work with SETI for a while, too. I redesigned their target list to pick out the best targets for searching for alien signals. And that exercise turns out to be pretty much exactly what you need to do to look for habitable planets, too.
Randy Olson, how about you? Inspired by any science fiction movies, any films when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah. But actually, the original Star Trek was probably the one for me, which sort of dates us.
We're talking to Dr. Randy Olson. He runs the planetarium and the observatory in UW-Stevens Point, and also Maggie Turnbull, Dr. Maggie Turnbull, who is searching for life on other worlds. She is an Antigo native, and she's taught at UW-Madison, and she runs something called the Global Science Institute, and she has done groundbreaking research with NASA in pioneering the search for extraterrestrial life. What do you think? Should we even be doing this? Should we be trying to contact other worlds? Should we be spending more money on it? Should we go to Mars? 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We're going to take a short break, but first, this news.
We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. The arrival of a spaceship in Washington. The Army has taken every precaution to meet any emergency which may develop. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
David Bowie takes us into the next segment of Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We are talking about the search for extraterrestrial life with astrobiologist Dr. Maggie Turnbull and also Randy Olson of the UW-Stevens Point Planetarium. And joining us right now from the Wausau West Planetarium is Chris Janssen, the Planetarium Director. Chris, good to have you on board.
Hey, thanks, guys. It's a really pleasure to be here.
And, Chris, you were just doing a presentation for some school kids this morning. What were you showing them?
Well, we take a look at the magic sky with 4K kids, 4K students, and they are so much fun. And the things they say, as people know, they say the darndest things.
How many high schools have their own planetarium? Not many, I imagine.
In Wisconsin, it's a small handful, it's about five. If you add on universities, actually overtake high schools with planetariums, and then you have some nature centers and some museums.
And how important is a planetarium in getting school kids interested in the subjects of astronomy and physics?
Well, there's actually a paper that was done by Rice University about 4 years ago. Dr. Carolyn Sumners had done a paper where she measured learning before and after an immersive environment. And what she determined from the study was that the same content delivered in a non-immersive environment, you get a lower retention rate. And so there's something about having the kids in an immersive environment like a planetarium that actually can increase any content that you wish to show them. So it's not just about space. And now we're showing kids about navigation with Lewis and Clark, biology and chemistry. So So it's many different thematic things can be enhanced in a planetarium. So I'd say really important, Glenn.
And we do have links to the Wausau West Planetarium and the New World site, which is something Maggie Turnbull is involved in, on that Route 51 Facebook page. Boy, you'll find a whole bunch of links there. Randy Olson, compare and contrast the planetarium at a high school level, Wausau West, and what you're doing at UWSP.
It depends somewhat upon the programming. I know what Chris is doing up here in terms of his programming, and it's fantastic for the local school district, but it doesn't wind up serving as much of the broader area around us. And we wind up doing a little bit more of that, although I know Chris is making some changes in that, I believe. But that's one of the main differences.
Yeah, the amount of reach you have. And Maggie Turnbull, planetariums in schools, this is something that some would consider a luxury, but others, I suspect you, would consider it not to be.
Well, I will just say that I have a little bit of experience with planetarium shows in school, and I'm loving hearing about the little kids right now because it's so true, like the way that their eyes just open up and, you know, I mean, what I've done in the past is make them lay down and close their eyes and then just tell them a story, you know, maybe about a hunter and a scorpion and a bull or something. And then when their eyes are dark adjusted, I let them open and the stars are on and you just hear these gasps, you know, coming from their little mouths, and they're just yours. And you can teach them anything, I feel like. And the questions just come pouring out. So I guess, you know, why would you not try to offer something like that if there's any way that you can?
1-800-780-9742. Let's go to the phones. We have Dorothy from Wausau. Dorothy, you're on with Maggie Turnbull, Chris Janssen, and Randy Olson.
Greetings, Earthlings. that's another Earthling.
Another species.
I would really like the guests, to comment on the various documentaries on, you know, cable TV and Netflix and on and on and on about artificial structures on the moon and Mars and et cetera.
Maggie Turnbull, is there anything to those?
Well, there definitely are artificial structures on the moon and Mars because
but we put them there.
But as far as technological origin or other artifacts.
Dorothy, I want you to hang up and listen off air, okay? All right, thanks so much. And Maggie, go on with your answer.
Yeah, I mean, as far as any other artifacts that did not come from humans visiting those places, there is just no evidence that I've seen that's even, you know, remotely compelling. I know that we want to believe that there are other civilizations out there that have visited us in the past, and scientifically we cannot rule that out as a possibility. But I think that we just approach it the same way we approach all questions in nature, and we have to have evidence that is pretty clear in order to make such extraordinary claims.
Well, we have the Voyager spacecraft right now, which is heading into the outer reaches of space. It's left the solar system, and it has images of human beings, and it also has a nice little map for the aliens showing them just how to find the planet Earth in our solar system. Is that something we even want to do? I mean, aren't you a little bit concerned that if the aliens come to Earth, it might end up like it happens in all those science fiction movies? They might not have the best intentions.
Yeah, the day might come when we want to revisit that decision, but it's been made and it's out there. And, you know, really the likelihood of someone running across these probes is pretty small. But, I mean, it is something to think about. And to be fair, I mean, look at how competitive life is on Earth, and just look at the way that we have treated our own planet, and it does raise some questions about whether we want to take a little more seriously the idea of monitoring for other civilizations that are far in advance of where we are and whether they would have any interest in us and our resources here.
You know, there was an old Saturday Night Live routine that Voyager spacecraft also has a record of sounds on the Earth, classical symphonies, and there's also Johnny Be Good by Chuck Berry on there. And the Saturday Night Live routine was the first contact with an alien civilization was the message, send more Chuck Berry. So, you know.
That's it's really fun in the movie Contact, you know, the opening sequence where they're zooming out from the Earth. If anybody out there hasn't seen the movie Contact, I'm begging you to watch it. But that first opening scene is really interesting because as you're backing away from the Earth, you're hearing all the sounds that have been broadcast over the years. And as you get farther and farther away, you hear the sounds of radio programs and TV shows from longer and longer ago. And then you get to a place where it's just silence. And, you know, our sphere of radio noise has now propagated out, depending on how you look at it, you know, 100 light years or so at most, which doesn't encompass very many stars, truthfully. That's not actually that many stars that will have heard our signals at this point. Well, but those signals will continue propagating out indefinitely.
Here's my question. The distances we're talking about are so huge. We're talking about hundreds, thousands of light years. The time it takes for light to travel in a year, it travels 186,000 miles per second. How is interstellar travel even possible, given those distances? Randy Olson?
Based on what we know, it isn't at this point, other than taking literally tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years.
Chris Janssen?
Well, Randy, you're right. Unless we come up with some new type of tech, like cryo-freeze or intergenerational spaceships. I always tell some groups how hilarious, well, it wouldn't be hilarious, but you get a group that's an intergenerational spaceship that's going to travel to Alpha Centauri. It's going to take, you know, 500 years, and the first generation that set sail will not achieve the mission, but the fifth generation will. And 500 years into the future, we develop warp drive or some super sci-fi, you know, breaking the laws of physics, and I can imagine the moment when the fifth generation ship arrives and up pulls a hot rod ship saying, hey, guys, we left this morning.
Maggie Turnbull, is warp drive even a possibility?
Okay, I have to tell you about this. So DARPA, which is the research, sort of the R&D wing of the Defense Department, they, a few years ago, sponsored a conference to attract the thinkers in the field, you know, even including, you know, some of the guys from the Apollo missions who are still around, and talk about the possibility of a 100-year spaceship. And the idea was to start a program that would, in 100 years, result in a spaceship with people on it leaving the solar system and colonizing the solar neighborhood. Not kidding. And a competition was, after that initial conference, there was a competition between different groups, which took this very seriously. I was on one of these teams, and we worked hard on our proposal. Competition for startup money from DARPA to put together an organization that could sustain that kind of research effort for the next 100 years and make it happen. And that 100-year spaceship conference, which was then followed up by another one a couple years later, and I believe they're continuing to do this. Mae Jemison, an astronaut, she won that competition and is now leading an organization to try to make this happen, and believe it or not. And there were sessions at these conferences about the possibility of warp drive and what, you know, what are the different ways, you know, that we could imagine getting humans to other planets around other stars. And I think the most intriguing question to come out of all of that was, how do you know when the starship gets there that people are going to want to get off the ship? That will be their home. And as far as they are concerned, it will be the thing that has sustained them across space.
And that is where the search for inhabitable planets comes in. Maybe right. Not to find the life that's already on those planets, but to find future habitation for human beings.
Yes, Absolutely. And I made the point at one of these meetings that if you fly my starshade with a telescope and I can come back to you with a list of destinations, then I have very strong faith actually in private industry to step up and say that right there is an opportunity and figure out a way to make it happen. We may not currently have, you know, any notion of how to accomplish this, but man, when there's an opportunity in play for something like space tourism and the opportunity to make that big of a dent in history, I think, you know, private industry might just step up.
Well, even thinking too, Maggie, about, you know, as a company or a corporation, that's pretty lucrative, basically claiming an entire planet on your spreadsheet for that year.
Should we be encouraging the commercialization of space? Should we be mining on the moon, for instance? What would the poets think about that? If you look up at the moon at night, you see a big mining colony there. Instead of the man on the moon, we're looking up at men on the moon.
Interesting. Well, they could do it on the far side so they don't mar our view of the moon, but on the other hand, you have to consider what would the poets have thought about mining on Earth? I mean, that's right in your backyard in many cases.
We're going to take a quick break. We've got Chris Janssen of the Wausau West Planetarium, Randy Olson of the UW Stevens Point Planetarium, Maggie Turnbull, astrobiologist, talking about the search for extraterrestrial life. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Here's Jimi Hendrix.
Tonight we are featuring an interview with a very peculiar-looking gentleman who goes by the name of Mr. Paul Caruso on the dodgy subject of are there or are there not flying saucers, or UFOs. Please, Mr. Caruso, could you give us your regarded opinion on this nonsense about spaceships and even space people?
Thank you. As you all know, you just can't believe everything you see and hear, can you? Now, if you will excuse me, I must be on my way.
But I can't believe it.
Must be those strangers that come every night. Those saucer-shaped lights put people uptight. Leave blue-green footprints that glow in the dark. I hope they get home all right. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along?
We have with us today on Route 51 Maggie Turnbull, an astrobiologist, Chris Janssen of the Wausau West Planetarium, and Randy Olson of the UW Stevens Point Planetarium. In the late 40s and all through the 50s, there was an incredible interest in flying saucers and UFOs, mass sightings, stories about an alien crash in Roswell, New Mexico. Was there something to all of that, Maggie Turnbull, or was this just a phenomenon of mass hysteria?
I think it might have been a phenomenon of something going on with the United States government that it was better to let people think it was aliens. I'm not sure, but I'm fairly well. I can tell you I've never seen any compelling evidence that's had anything to do with an alien visit.
Well, there were a number of these eyewitness UFO files released by the government back in January, 130,000 pages of declassified documents, many of them from Project Blue Book. I don't know if any of you on the show today had a chance to read about them or see them. If so, did you find anything interesting?
I'd like to comment, Glenn, if that's
okay.
Okay,
yeah.
There is a fantastic book, Carl Sagan's last book, Demon Haunted World, and he provides, like, there's a couple of chapters in there where the whole idea of a saucer, flying saucer, is actually a misquote from a pilot, an airplane pilot, describing what he saw, and it turns out it was some lenticular clouds. The newspaper locally misquoted him as a saucer, and then it just took off from there. I think Carl Sagan refers to it as a mass delusion that had been propagated, as there is no compelling evidence. And he produces another chapter about alien abductions. And if you look at the number of reported alien abductions, and he did the math on this, and I think it turns out to be like every 12 days, someone in the 1980s through early 90s, every 12 days there would be someone abducted. Surely someone would have seen their neighbor getting beamed up to a spacecraft.
Well, that leads me to another question. If there is intelligent alien life out there capable of space travel, why haven't we seen them yet, Maggie Turnbull?
Well, maybe they're not interested in coming here, or maybe they're, they don't take a form that we would recognize, or maybe the kind of civilization that is capable of persisting for that long, that many centuries and millennia, to even get to that point where you're traveling and colonizing the galaxy. Maybe that kind of civilization has to be inherently more peaceful and is not in order to just simply be stable and get such an incredible thing accomplished. And, there was actually a paper published in the Astrophysical Journal a couple decades ago suggesting the zoo hypothesis, that the Earth and the solar system have been set aside as a wilderness area or zoo, been protected.
Randy Olson, what do you think of that?
Interesting ideas, but when you take a look at the possibility of us having been visited, you have to realize that if somebody was, first of all, technologically that advanced to be able to accomplish interstellar travel, they may also be easily avoidable in terms of our perceptions. So we may not know that. And secondly, is when you start looking at all of these supposed cases and sightings, especially back in the 1970s and 80s, a lot of that actually did have to do with the concerns and the political consternation of the day. In fact,
the whole Cold War environment, the threat of nuclear war, and so on.
Yeah, to some extent. In fact, the quote that Chris Janssen had made in terms of a misquote of the report on a object that flew like a saucer was actually something that we're taking a look at in our April planetarium programs at UW-Stevens Point, a program called Bad Astronomy.
We're almost out of time, so I'm going to ask all three of you a quick question, and I'm going to preface it this way. We have evidence that Mars was once much more inhabitable than it is now, with a lot of flowing water and even some organic material. Do you think that there was once life on Mars, and could there still be life on Mars, maybe microbes still viable beneath the frozen surface? Randy, let's start with you.
That would be a real big stretch, but we have found a variety of life forms in very inhospitable places here on our planet. So probably not.
Chris Janssen, very quickly, we're running out of time.
Okay. On Earth, we found extremophiles, life that can exist in Mars-like conditions. It is possible. I've got to think I'm a rational thinker. If you don't have evidence, it's nothing, in my mind.
And Maggie Turnbull, we're down to our last 10 seconds here.
Yep, I think it's possible, and we have to look for it.
And we will be looking for it if the president goes forward with his proposal and he gets the backing in Congress. Do you think we should go to Mars, Maggie Turnbull?
I think we should explore as much as we possibly can, either with rovers and instruments or eventually with people. But I'd start with the instruments and get underneath that surface.
Thank you so much for being with us. And we do want to thank today's guests, Dr. Margaret Maggie Turnbull of the Global Science Institute. You can catch up with her at whizspacegirl.blogspot.com. Also, Dr. Randy Olson, professor of physics and astronomy and director of the Allen F. Blocker Planetarium and the Observatory at UW-Stevens Point. Find out more at uwsp.edu. And Chris Janssen, director of the Wausau School District Planetarium at Wausau West High School. Find out more at wausauspace.org. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer and on-air producer, Rick Ryer. Special music today by Paul Kantner and Jefferson Starship, Jimi Hendrix, David Bowie, the trailer from the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still, Mr. Spaceman by the Byrds, and Telstar by the Tornadoes. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.